Yes. On pensions and retirement will come to order. Our first item on the agenda today is the Siegel Company is here to talk about actuarial issues and to give us an overview that we haven't heard for many a year. Did you say 2003 was the last time? Mr. Martin, was that?
Sounds about right.
Yeah. And so it's been a long time. And so we certainly welcome Mr. Levi and Ms. Eidelberg and Ms. Hogarth from the Siegel Company. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
We would also like to thank you for having us here. The chairwoman said it's been a while since you've had a report, and we have come before you today to report on the status of statewide and first-class city pension plans. I wanted to introduce our team first and talk about what we do. So as the chairwoman said, I'm Kathy Eidelberg. I'm the Siegel Company's National Director for the Public Sector Market. And I'm not an actuary, but my background is very much in public pension policy and healthcare policy. And so that's what I bring to the systems. Tom Levy is our chief actuary for the company. We have over 200 actuaries in the company, so he's a busy guy, but he pays particular attention to this case. Susan Hogarth, who is over here to my right, is the day-to-day consulting actuary for the Minnesota plans. Also on the team but not here today are Andre Latia. He's a FSA. He's in our Chicago office. And Brad Ramirez, also a FSA in our Denver office. What does the Siegel Company do for the Minnesota plans? We prepare the annual actual evaluation as of July for the statewide and first-class city pension plans and provide those copies to the LCPR. And we have completed that task for this year, and you have those reports. We also, every 4 years, complete a experience study. And an experience study basically is looking backwards to see if the assumptions that had been used in recent past valuations are playing out, or do they need to be adjusted. And the last experience study was done in 2001, in 2005, but it covered the period of 2000 to 2004. And we have several recommendations before you today about assumption changes based on that experience study. As you know, the LCPR can take action on certain sets of assumptions. Others need statutory change. And we have a handout for you today which lists out, breaks them out both by what's under your direct jurisdiction and what is under the statute. And we're hoping that today you will consider the ones under your jurisdiction and be able to move forward with those. The systems have not had their assumptions adjusted for a number of years now. We provide the boards and staffs of the plans updates on items of interest to governmental retirement plans, and that's something that I spend quite a bit of time on, watching what's going on in Washington, D.C., and also around the country. What are other systems doing on specific topics? We provide the boards and staff actual support for legislative questions, and we provide the LCPR with updated information as requested. Just very quickly, I'd like to go through the materials that are in front of you today. The first one is our presentation. The second one, as I mentioned, is a list of both the statutory and the LCPR assumption changes where we're making recommendations, and also backup in this handout for each of the systems on their specific recommendations. And we're going to go through that in the overall presentation as well. And then also for the 2007-2008 valuations, you have the LCPR summary report of all of the plans. So those things are before you. We are basically going to work through the presentation, but we wanted to make sure that you had the background of all of these issues as we go through the presentation. I am going to turn it over to Tom Levy. And the agenda for today, these are the items. We'll talk about pension funding in general, what it is, how it works, actuarial assumptions, what they are, and what the specific changes that we are recommending for each of the plans, actuarial results and evaluation, and then the key issues that the systems have identified that they would like you to have more information about and have more in-depth discussion. So with that, I'm turning it over to Tom.
Mr. Levy.
Good morning. What we're talking about this morning are 13 plans altogether, which collectively have roughly $50 billion, with a B, in assets, may very well be the largest pool of assets in the entire state, or if not, awfully close to it. So it's an important responsibility for you folks, for the administrators, for all of us. Again, can't underestimate what $50 billion means in terms of many things with regard to the state. So turning to slide four, okay, Kathy's ahead of me, that's good, as is usually the case. I'm going to do a brief introduction because we haven't been here before on what we're talking about. There's a certain amount of lingo, there's technical issues, and in order to understand our reports and the issues before you, we thought it would be helpful to just do a short introduction to what actuaries do for pension plans and why it matters to you. So we're going to start with pension funding 101, sort of the actuary's favorite equation. For a pension plan, there's no magic, there's no free lunch. The contributions and the investment income pay for benefits and expenses. The most important thing that all of you do with these pension plans is pay benefits. But the benefits themselves are fundamentally set by the applicable laws. There's not a lot of discretion, really almost no discretion in the benefit payments. And the expenses, the other outgo, are a very small piece and very little discretion there. The inflow side, on the other hand, those two items are a trade-off. In particular, the more investment income you have, the less you have to use of taxpayer money for contributions. It's as simple as that. And so when it comes to pensions, the largest part of the time, the largest part of the energy of the pension boards will tend to go towards the maximizing the investment income because that's where their effectiveness has the greatest impact on the taxpayers. The more successful the investment program is, the less the taxpayers have to put in for the same benefits. So that's an important foundation piece to know about. Pensions are basically different from the rest of the labor costs. For most of your labor costs, it's dollars go in, dollars go out. Employee salaries, medical insurance, life insurance. It's right in, right out. Comes and goes. Pensions are very different. They're deferred compensation. And so the money that is going in today for the people who are working today is to provide them pensions sometime in the future. And it is not an immediate in-out payment, and that's why there is $50 billion. Because that's what's there for all the retirees, for all the people who are working for the time they've already worked, we'll talk in a few minutes about how adequate that is. But it's a fundamentally different system of compensation than the rest of the compensation for the state employees and the first-class city employees. And this is very important because for most of your labor costs, the cost is determinable. And if you don't pay it right away, there's an immediate impact on your employees. You don't put in the payroll, they don't get paid. All sorts of problems presumably will happen if that goes forth, or on the medical insurance, things like that. On the pension side, on the other hand, the employer's cost is an estimate. It's related to uncertain events that are many years in the future. There is this $50 billion pool of assets. And so if a public employer doesn't fully and promptly fund the pension plan, the pension checks still go out. The payroll deductions still happen on the employees' paychecks. There isn't an immediate impact. And one of the things that has been observed over the past probably 30 years or so, some maybe even more, is that when a public employer has a budget shortfall, the fact that they can short fund the pension and not have the pension stop becomes a very attractive but fiscally dangerous option. And why is it fiscally dangerous? Well, that comes back to the basic question. Why does a government fund pensions at all? And it's important that you know that. Well, sort of the first reason for funding a pension is benefit security. But the public employers are sovereign entities that are not sold. They don't go bankrupt. Employees feel more comfortable seeing $50 billion than, as was the case a few years ago in West Virginia, where they were seeing zero, where I believe it was the teacher's plan. But ultimately, the state isn't going to be sold. We don't think it's going to go bankrupt. And the state's obligated to pay these pensions. Very different from what the employees across the street at Northwest have gone through with regard to their pensions because of the bankruptcy, because of the issues of perhaps merger of Northwest with another airline. Those issues presumably don't apply to the state of Minnesota. Level funding. Level funding is important. The tax base that currently supports a plan is likely to be able to do so in the future. Tell a quick story on a state that I won't name, but they decided that the way to balance the state's budget was to legislate some changes in the funding. And what it meant was the funding for the state employees plan went from 10% of payroll to zero. And then it would creep back over a period of years to 13%. And that actually became a major court case in the state, and the state's highest court ruled that the legislature and the governor had no power to do that under the state constitution. But part of our testimony in that case was just that, that to try to put the state on a funding pattern where their pension cost was going to go from 0 to 13% over 10 to 12 years was simply creating an impossible budgeting problem for the state. And it would solve the immediate problem and create horrendous ones for the future. So level funding is very important. Lower cost. Investment income pays a significant part of the cost. That's nice. It means it doesn't have to come out of tax dollars. But there's a second, less obvious piece of it. To the extent that you owe people pensions and you haven't paid for them while they were working, you're borrowing. And you're borrowing at something close to double the state's normal borrowing rate. It is very expensive borrowing. What rate are you borrowing at? You anticipate in the actuarial calculations that the plans over the long run will earn 8.5%. So on an anticipated basis, the funding charge, if you underfund, will not only be that you have to come up with the money later, but coming up later, it will be 8.5% per annum higher, a lot higher than your normal borrowing costs for long-term obligations, that you're going to have to pay. It won't get called interest cost on the state's books. It'll get called pension cost. But it's an awfully expensive way to borrow. And the real rate you're borrowing at is what the system actually earns. Because if the system had had the money, it would have earned what it earned on the rest of its money. If it doesn't have it, go back to that basic calculation. The investment income is less. The contributions will be more. No free lunch. So that's an important economic decision to make when you say, oh, let's go a little more slowly on the funding of the plan, is you have to understand that you're borrowing at rates that the fund is going to earn, not at your normal borrowing cost.
Are we supposed to ask questions at the end only?
I think on this one you may.
Okay. The question, Madam Chairman, the question I would then have is that this is something that one local unit in Minnesota has done, the city of Minneapolis, and they've borrowed to pay pension costs. So I thought that was one of the most outrageous things that I've ever heard, but you seem to say, your last statement seems to say that that makes sense.
Well,
Mr. Levy.
Yeah, it has to be looked at in the totality of it. And the first thing is that as a general rule, IRS has anti-arbitrage rules where if you borrow money for the purpose of investing it, you don't get the same tax breaks that you typically get. So if you wind up having to borrow at 7 or 8 or 8.5% at fully taxable rates, it may not be the same advantage. And again, it is which pocket it comes out of, but certainly one of the things you need to consider, at least in the course of normal funding, as opposed to borrowing to just in effect move a liability from the pension fund to the municipality itself, because that's all that you're doing, is alternatives, is what the tax situation is going to be, is how you are dealing with various of these other issues, such as level funding, such as the one I was about to go to on the top of this slide, which is having the right taxpayers pay for the services they get from the employees who are serving them. As West Virginia has discovered, we'll make them our poster child today, although they've seen the light and have changed their behavior drastically. If you don't fund, then what you have is you folks wind up having to come up with the money to pay for the pensions of the people who have long ago stopped providing public service. And, in effect, your predecessors have made a conscious or unconscious decision to let the current generation pay for all the work that they got out of the people who worked 20 years ago. And so it isn't a simple decision. There may be times when it's right, but but doing it that way may work on the investment side. It's also not really you do have to invest taxably, representative, then you also have the question of risk, because you don't get an 8.5% rate of return without taking the risk that 2000 to 2002 might happen. So there is also risk that, you know, we tend to say, oh, sooner or later, the pension's a long-term proposition. Markets will go up. We'll be fine. But most funds, and we haven't looked at it for these, while they have certainly more than made up for all the losses of 2000 to 2002, they are still well short of where they would have been if 2000 to 2002 had never happened. Hope that's helpful in terms of looking at it, but it's a fair question. Okay. So we said, just good financial practice, good business practice as the custodians of the taxpayers' money, is to see that today's taxpayers pay for the deferred compensation of today's workers, and that that isn't passed along to some other generation, and vice versa. That you don't say, hey, we're going to jump in and we're going to pay all the costs for the people who are going to work for the next 20 years and let them spend the money on health care and education and all the other things that you folks have to find resources to deal with. And that's one of the things about pension. We'll come to it soon. A very small change in pension costs, when pensions are so big, can be the funding or not funding of any number of other important state programs that have nothing to do with pensions. But the dollars are so big that the just normal year-to-year swings in pension costs can have huge implications for everything else the state does. And that's a difficult challenge. The last item I want to talk about on this slide is one of the things we've observed is that legislatures and administrations, if the plan isn't funded properly and if they don't have to really come up with the cash, don't pay much attention to what benefit improvements cost. And so a long time ago, I was the actuary for a state that had an unfunded system, and they wanted to improve certain benefits, and we got asked what the cost was, and we said, well, here's what the level funding cost is, but since it's only increases to people who are already retired, people who are not yet retired, there will be no cash implication to the state for the next budget period. Well, you can bet how popular that was. That was the only number they cared about. Oh, we can give the workers something in lieu of a pay raise, and we'd have to come up with money for the pay raise, but if we do it on the pension, then we don't have to pay anything. So that's great. We love that. That's what we'll do. Not making that up. So that is an important function. Okay, so that's why funding. Now let's get to how funding. And if you've read our reports cover to cover, as I doubt any one of you has, certainly hope you haven't, but hopefully you've read the highlight section of each. The first component of the pension cost is the portion allocated the current year for the new accruals based on current employment. Okay, let's
somebody must have their telephone on.
Okay. I have mine on quiet, but if that might be throwing some interference out, let me just turn it off.
I think it might.
Okay.
But I'm sure it wasn't you.
Okay. That's what the pilot tells us when we forgot to turn off our phone on the airplane. So, obviously, you've got people working today. As a result of their working today, they earn some new pension. We call that the normal cost. That's sort of a traditional actuarial jargon term. But that's what it means, and sort of to give you a non-pension analogy, it's in a house, it's the cost of keeping the house this year. The real estate taxes, the maintenance, utilities, insurance. This year's cost just goes with having a house, having a pension plan. There's people earning new pieces of pension. So that's a core element of the cost. Then the second element is to the extent that not all of the pensions that have been earned for past work have been fully paid for. There is something that we call an unfunded actuarial liability, and the house equivalent is the mortgage on the house. And you pay it off like a mortgage over a period of years with annual amortization payments. And there's nothing wrong with that. Almost every state has that. Sometimes it comes from what happened in 2000 to 2002. Sometimes it comes from people living longer. Sometimes it comes from adding new benefits, and where the new benefits help people who are already retired or help people with regard to the service they've already come in. So just like there is nothing wrong with having a mortgage payment on your house, there is nothing wrong with having an amortization payment on your pension plan. And those two pieces make up the...
See, I told you it wasn't you.
Okay, I appreciate that. So we're going to go through a couple of slides here on how this works. So just what we do, it'll be quick. It's a cute graph, so we'll go with it. But basically, we start with the key things that define what the calculated cost of the plan is. The plan provisions, the data about the participants, and the actuarial assumptions about what their future behavior will be in terms of collecting their pensions. And we toss that into the computer, which here is the present value generator. Say, what's that all worth today? What are all the benefits we're ever going to pay our current employees and retirees worth? We then put that through our actuarial model and through something called the funding method, and we divide it into the red piece, which is the piece of the benefits that the people haven't yet earned. They haven't worked yet to earn those benefits. So those are benefits that will be paid for in the future, for work to be done in the future, not expected to be funded now under any test. The rest, the blue and the yellow, are what we call the actuarial liability, and that's the benefits that have already been earned. And as you see in the slideshow here, some of them, the portion that's already funded, are the asset part of the circle, and the unfunded part, the yellow part, is the portion that's has to be paid off by mortgage payments. Just like in your house, the asset piece is the equity in the house, and the unfunded liability is what you owe in future mortgage payments. So, what happens then is the contributions are the two pipes we just added, talked about on the previous page. The normal cost payments are state appropriations or first-class city appropriations or educational fund appropriations or participant contributions. And those go up to make up the right-hand pipe, the current normal cost, so that goes into the fund. And then the mortgage payments, the payments on the unfunded liability, coming out of the yellow part of the circle, are the other piece. So that's how the pieces that aren't already funded get funded. And that all goes down into our VAT here and make up the plan assets. Then finally, to complete the picture, we see on the right side that the plan design generates benefit payments out and expenses also come out. Whatever is left in assets goes through what you'll see here labeled policy and investment policy, gets invested, it produces the second source of assets, the investment income, and hopefully not much in the way of down the drain losses on the far left. So that's how pension funding works.
Mr. Levy, how come the far left losses are blue?
Well, when you
could paint them red.
Okay. Because this slide, the origin of this slide is actually many decades ago in black and white in the Harvard Business Review, as I understand. And so whoever decided to do a Ted Turner and colorize it for us chose blue. But
good suggestion.
But an interesting suggestion. I think it's just the idea that all the cash flows are blue. And our graphic designer didn't think about it as hey, we could make them different colors. But
okay.
But you will notice that I'm wearing a blue tie and not a red one.
Uh-huh. Is that so, company policy?
Well, the policy is actually to wear a black tie when the plan's in the black, a red tie when the plan's in the red, and a striped tie when it's on target. But I guess I haven't quite been on with policy on that. So how do we do all this? We do this with something called actuarial valuations, and evaluation is nothing more than an annual snapshot of the plan's funding, and its principal purpose is to reconcile what we had done in the past, which is a forecast of uncertain future events, with, now that we know at least for the most recent year what actually happened, with what actually happened. Because it isn't uncertain anymore. And so every year, one of the things we do in evaluation is we say, how did our forecast hold up compared to what actually happened, and should we true it up? So there are short-term variations, and we call those gains and losses. This year, the investment income was a little better, a little worse. People retired a little earlier, a little later, whatever. We don't think that changes the forecast. But we have to reflect the year that did happen. A bigger impact is if you say, hey, but this has happened 4 or 5 years in a row, and maybe now it's... There really is a different pattern than when we last set assumptions. So Kathy talked before about experience studies, where you take several years' experience and you look at it as a period of years and see whether there's a pattern there and it's different. Sort of like a moonshot. You know, you get a little off track, NASA tracks it. Hey, it's going towards the moon. Hey, it's not going towards the moon. Let's correct it a little. But if every correction is the same direction, then NASA may say, we better change our model. There's something going on here that's always going off to the right towards Saturn, and maybe we better just change where we're aiming a little bit more to the left so that we hit the moon. And then, of course, in the last few years, GASB has come out with accounting principles for these plans. And one of the things we're going to talk about a bit today is the impact of GASB's having said, if you want to say that the state's books are in accordance with accepted actuarial practice for governmental plans, then there are certain things you have to do. So, fundamentally, Minnesota is on side with all of this. The pension costs are calculated to remain level as an exempt payroll.
Madam Chair, I apologize, but I'm waiting for a call that I can't miss due to a surgery today, so I'm sorry about the buzzing, but I have to do that for a little while. Thank you.
Okay, well, one of the things that I do as my hobby is actually performing on stage for live audiences, so I talk loud enough that if you determine that this is a problem, we have to turn this off, I think everybody can hear me.
I'm not sure we know how to do that either.
Oh. Anyway, going to the second bullet on this page, the required contribution rates are redetermined each year with each valuation. But we all understand the significant changes from year to year are potentially problematic for the budget process, particularly if there are increases. You need to take a long-term view here. But some volatility is inevitable. And so one of the things that the boards do, that we do, that you do, is say, well, within limits, what can we do to manage the volatility? As we said, it's not going to, you're trying to run a whole state, not just a pension plan. And you don't like to be told, hey, we've got a whatever $100 million budget deficit, and particularly don't like to be told that the reason is something over which you have no control, which is the markets didn't give you 8.5% on the pension cost. So there are a couple of things that Minnesota does to try to manage volatility. The first is to change the contribution rates by considered legislative action, not automatically. So some states, the process is, actuary does the report, the state is obligated in the budget for not that fiscal year, but the following one, to fund whatever the actuary comes up with. That takes some discretion out, which is sometimes very good, but in terms of managing volatility, obviously it misses a place to manage volatility, whereas you folks keep that opportunity by saying ultimately the rates will only change if the elected representatives vote to make the change, with full understanding of the consequences, as we discussed before. The thing that changes most frequently in a pension plan, where you get most of your gains and losses, is ordinarily on the investment side. Life insurance, you can have a tragedy where a lot of people die because of one event, as we saw in New Orleans. Pension plans, the high cost event is people living longer. We've learned that they can't do that faster than 1 year at a time. That gives you an opportunity to think about how are we going to address this change, because it isn't going to be a rapid change. But the investment side is different. The investment side, as we've all learned in the last decade, can change up or down a lot quickly. The last item is the assumption changes, which is a major thing that we're here to talk about today. But those are normally only changed in conjunction with an experience study. That is where you've got a pattern of something happening over and over and over. My moonshot, it's going off the same direction every time. Now, one of the things that you folks have to deal with that your predecessors didn't is as plans become older, more assets, more mature, have been around a longer time, there is inevitably more volatility. When the assets were $5 billion, a 1% gain or loss was $50 million. Spread that out over 5 years, maybe have, if it's a bad year, have a good year, take care of that for you. Now the assets are 10 times as much, but the payroll isn't 10 times as much. So that same 1% change causes a contribution as gain or loss on the investment, when we're talking about $50 billion, has a much bigger impact on the contribution rate than it did, whatever, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, when it was $5 billion, not $50. There's nothing you can do about it. It's just inevitable when you have a pension plan. And so that's a challenge for you folks. The other thing is, to the extent that some of these plans are fairly small, inevitably in anything, you get more variation from year to year in a small group, sort of statistics 101, than in a huge group. Indeed, one of the things you're a little different from many other states is many other states will have only three statewide plans, some even only two. They'll have a state employees plan, they'll have a teacher's plan, and sometimes those are combined into a single one, and they'll have a municipal employees plan. So they don't have any small plans. For whatever historic reasons, you have chosen to have 13 plans covering the exact same group. That means some of the smaller ones will have more variability because retirement patterns, things like that, just the normal statistical differences. The run when you win five hands in a row at the blackjack table in Las Vegas. That happens. It's expected to happen. Those things, good and bad, happen more in small plans than in big plans. So, we stop for 1 second. That's the basic, what do we hear about, what do we do? We can hold questions, or we can take a few if there are any on that now. We're going to now start getting a little more specific. Okay.
Please go ahead.
Good. One of the things about good consulting is it is teaching. And that's what we're trying to do today. The next issue is actuarial assumption. You recall one of the blocks that went into our plumbing slide was the actuarial assumptions. In Minnesota, certain assumptions are managed by legislative action. The entire legislature has to vote on things like the investment return, the asset valuation. That is becoming rarer and rarer in the public sector, to have the assumptions determined by a full vote of the entire legislature. When I started in this business, it was fairly common. But it's a world that changes enough that to have to go to the legislature every time is an unusual thing. You still do it. Something for you to consider. The more typical pattern would be to have something like you have for a lot of the other assumptions, the green box here, which is a small subgroup that focuses on retirement issues, makes those decisions. Hopefully a more effective, faster process. One of the things that's important to do, and that's difficult to do if legislators are involved in at all, frankly, is when there is a clear signal that change is required, to get those changes made. But when it's the entire legislature that has to consider it and vote on it, you've lost several years typically before the changes that need to be made get made. So the closer you can bring the change process to the people who have a specific responsibility for pensions, the retirement boards and you folks, the better.
So, Mr. Levy, you're saying that your green group would be non-legislators, but people that are part of the pensions?
No, there are two models that are more common out there. The first model is essentially the boards have full control, but there are some ex officio members of the boards. So the Secretary of Finance, the Secretary of Human Resources may actually be members of the pension boards. There may be a couple of legislators on the pension boards so that there is participation in the assumption setting process, but the final decision on the assumptions is made solely by the boards. So that's one model. Another model, the one that you're in for some assumptions, is the boards may make recommendations to a small legislative group that is only responsible for retirement type issues and that can be expected to have a better level of working knowledge and a better appreciation of the time frame that's necessary for prompt action. So that's another model that's out there, and that's closer to yours, except you're applying it only for some of the assumptions, and most states will apply one of those models for everything. In managing the assumptions, first of all, it requires professional actuarial judgment. That's our business. That's why we have a profession called actuary. It's not because we need somebody who can make the computer give you the numbers. It's because we have somebody who can apply professional judgment and help you decide what works best so that you can make the right decisions given what you know about the employees and the taxpayers of Minnesota. And the reason judgment is required is because there's a range of reasonable assumptions. We're talking about a forecast of future events. There isn't a single right answer. Accountants tend to be looking backwards, and there is more or less a single right answer. I know they'll be jumping on my back for saying that if you give 100 accountants the same information that they'll all come up with the same books. They won't. But fundamentally, looking forward is very different from looking backward in terms of a right answer. And within that range, assumptions can be what we call aggressive, more optimistic. They provide a lower current contribution. Hey, the future is going to be better. The investment income is going to be higher. Let's put in less money. That has a higher risk and a lower dollar amount today. Conservative is our kind of code word for assumptions that do the reverse. Have a higher cost now, but less risk of future increases. For most of the assumptions, including all the ones that this group deals with, the assumptions closely reflect recent experience, and the proposal for you folks today is to make some very modest true-ups to some where behavior has gotten sort of consistently off, some better, some worse, against experience. For the major ones that are in the hands of the full legislature, on the other hand, I think our professional judgment would be they are moderately aggressive. Compared to other states, they are on the low-cost side. And those are that most states use an 8% assumption as to future investment income. You're using 8.5%. Now, in all fairness, you're being more proactive, more aggressive in your management of the investment policy. You are making more of an effort and taking somewhat more risk, I would guess, to try to get that higher return. So that expectation may not be inappropriate. But compared to what other states are assuming, you're a little bit higher. You're at 8.5. A little more will come out of investment income than they would be doing, and therefore a little less can come out of contribution. That's obviously a desirable outcome, but it has a different risk level. The other is the costs are calculated to remain level as a percent of pay. As you will see later, the systems are proposing to change to a lower assumption as to future inflation levels, and in doing that, they are lowering their recommendation with regard to future payroll growth. But still, sort of getting ahead of myself, they're assuming that in a 3% inflation environment and with a constant workforce, not a growing workforce, that the state's payroll will grow on average 4.5% a year. That's, again, a little on the high side compared to what I think most states would do, but may be completely appropriate here. So, again, just to summarize, we've got statutory assumptions where the entire legislature must pass judgment on them, and that's on this slide. And those tend to be how long a mortgage to pay off the unfunded liability and the economic assumptions. And in that regard, there have been extensive discussions since the beginning of this year between the directors of the retirement systems on behalf of their boards, ourselves, and some of the systems have their own actuarial firm, a company called Mercer, whose name you'll see here. We have all been in extended discussions over what changes are appropriate at this time.
Why don't I just mention, Bonnie Wirtz from Mercer is here, and we work very closely with Mercer, back and forth, working on these assumption setting, and so that there's kind of a immediate check and double check on how we are approaching these assumptions. Bonnie is right here. Okay, so.
Ms. Wirtz.
Okay. So, first of all, starting. So now we're going to get very specific to Minnesota. Up until now, we've been sort of talking at 30,000 feet. We're going to move to 30 feet. We're going to tackle now very specific issues to these 13 systems. So we're going to start with the ones that cover people who work for the state, which are the plans. Where the acronym is MSRS, Minnesota State Retirement System. And so you'll see no changes being recommended on the smoothing techniques on the asset side as a volatility management piece. No changes being recommended in the 8.5% investment return. As I just said, the inflation projections for the future have been significantly lowered to reflect what we've seen for over a decade now, and in effect the change in how the Federal Reserve is managing inflation. The salary increases for the future are either being kept the same or lowered, and the payroll growth assumption, the recommendation, collective recommendation, is to lower that somewhat. Moving on to the other systems, the three that cover primarily the municipal employees, the changes are fundamentally the same. They aren't all starting the same place, but they're coming out about in the same place. And that is also true for the teacher's retirement plan, the TRA. Going to Duluth, we have just done an extended experience study, and that is primarily reflected at this point. Their board has not yet reached conclusions, frankly, on the actuarial value of assets, investment return, and inflation assumptions. So the no change there isn't that they have decided to not make a change. It is just that they have, the timing of their experience study is a year later. So they haven't addressed those issues yet. But the other changes are the same. For St. Paul and for the closed systems, there are no changes being recommended with regard to those assumptions. For those that are in your ballpark, actually, we can just go on to the next page. There are substantial changes in that there are many things that are being changed, but they are not big changes. So with regard to withdrawal, you'll see that for the state employees, younger females are actually leaving the workforce at a lower rate. They are staying longer with the state than has been the case historically. So you'll see sort of in the top left box under withdrawal state employees that we're actually decreasing the female rates of leaving state service. Now, that is socially perhaps a good thing. You're better judges of that than I am. But it is a cost increasing element for a pension plan because it means more of them are going to stay long enough to get a pension and they'll get a bigger pension.
Good.
Looking at Duluth, on the other hand, at the bottom of the page, you'll say select period means in the early years of employment. You'll see that people are actually leaving teaching in Duluth in the early years at a higher rate than before. And so that's a recommended change there. With regard to disability, mostly it's the same, except for state employees at older ages. Retirement is an important cost element. If people retire earlier, that means they're going to collect their pension for a longer period of time, and that tends, even though it's a smaller pension, to be an increasing cost event. That is, the longer the people work for the state, and therefore you're paying them a paycheck, not a pension check, that tends to be less costly for the state, and retiring earlier tends to be more costly. And as you look down the retirement column, you'll see that the retirement rates, particularly under the rule of 90, which is the most expensive kind of retirement, are increasing. The people are tending to retire earlier than they have historically, and that increases the pension cost. Mortality, you'll see the tables are pretty much up to date, but there are some changes, and unlike all the other assumptions, mortality tends to go one direction. People living longer, and as we said, in a pension plan, that's a cost increase. So do not be surprised if you stay on this commission for a while, that from time to time we will be coming back and saying the mortality table needs to be changed. People are living longer. Again, sort of one of the strange things is for most of the things you're involved with, the wonderful things that you love are low interest rates and long and people living a long time. On the pension plan, the reverse is true. But you have to look at it in terms of the totality. Okay, so those are the changes in a nutshell that we're talking about today. Senator, you look like you have a question here.
Senator Lynch. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, Mr. Levy, you made some recommendations and comments only on some funds. So,
right, there are no changes being proposed for the others.
For the others, but you did look at all of the others.
Not all, but most, certainly all the big ones have had experience studies within the last 2 years, and also, obviously, in terms of the dollars and cents that you're responsible for, those are the ones that have the big price tags attached.
Senator.
And we will get to that.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Levy, then a follow-up question. On the
the funds that you did look at that are listed and provided for us here today, and I'm looking particularly at the LCPR recommended changes. In doing that, as you looked at withdrawal, disability, retirement, mortality, is it best when you're looking at those assumptions to look at all of those various assumptions or perhaps just one particular assumption, let's say just mortality?
No, we look at each one individually, or actually for most of these, Bonnie and her colleagues looked at them individually, and make decisions on recommendations, yes, individually, but also looking at the totality. Because, as an example, you wouldn't want to be conservative at the conservative end of the range on every single assumption, because that's assuming everything goes bad at once. So even if each of those ones individually, you've now said, hey, let's build a little safety margin in, it might be that if you did that, that the total safety margin would just be much too much. So it is looked at, the studies are done each assumption individually. We start with, well, what looks best for each one individually? But then when we've looked at all of them together, we say, does this make sense as a package? Has that answered your question?
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, if I could just further clarify. So, and I don't know if this is a question for Mr. Levy or for the chair or for staff, but in the past, when changes have been made in assumptions to these plans, has the commission looked in totality at those assumptions, or has it been the practice that one particular assumption has been reviewed?
Okay, it predates our involvement. This is our fourth actuarial evaluation for the state.
But only one experience.
And it's only one experience study. My impression has been that the commission has voted on them as a package. That your recollection, Madam Chair? And with as much or as little study as it felt it needed or was willing to give to the question.
Mr. Martin?
Yes, members. In the past, at least going back to 1986, when a single actuarial firm was retained to do all 13 or 14 evaluations, and the practice has been to look at the various experience studies, look at the recommendations of the actuary, take testimony from the pension funds if there's a question about some changes that they are uncomfortable with, to look somewhat carefully at the experience studies, at least have the staff look at the experience studies. Is it clear from the experience studies that a change is needed first? And then the second question is the proposed new assumption, does that seem to fit right? And to flag any that seem to be problematic for you, and then at the conclusion of that process to then make the changes.
Thank you. Mr. Levy?
Okay, now moving to the next item on our agenda, which is the actual results of our reports. First of all, just as an update, you should all have received copies of our reports, and one of the things we're available to do today is answer questions on them. But just to give you on one page sort of a summary of where they came out, and then we're going to look behind them in the next few minutes. You can see for each one, and I'm not going to go read out loud to you, we have shown in the first column for each of the systems what the current rate is established by the legislature, the current contribution rate is. For several of the systems, you'll see the legislature has already adopted future increases to try to improve the funding of those plans. And so the so-called ultimate rate is the highest rate. It may be as late as fiscal 2010, but it's the highest rate that the legislature has already set for the system. And some of them, you'll see it's no change, and in others it's an increase. And then the last column is the straight-up result of this year's actuarial reports for each system in terms of what our calculations say, in quotes, should be contributed. Now, again, in some states, once we came out with the report, the governor would be obligated to put in his or her budget for the coming year that number. That is not how you operate. So you have the ability, through the full legislature, to consider these issues, and we will be talking more about them. I do want to jump ahead to the next page because there's a critical element in these. And for the moment, I'm going to look at the three big systems with you. The same numbers are on the other pages for the smaller ones, but I'm not going to dwell on them. The first is, how well-funded is it? And you'll see, quote, after MPRIF, which is the post-fund, asset method change. As you may recall, one of the things that I believe the legislature did was, in response to the state auditor's report last year, to change how assets are valued, or what the asset value is for the post fund, the fund covering the responsibilities for pensioners. Specifically, historically, it was, as a matter of law, simply asserted that the assets and the liabilities were equal. Whatever we calculated as the liabilities, that was the assets. Well, guess what? That wasn't what the assets really were. So there was a hidden liability, a hidden unfunded liability, that just wasn't showing up on the books. And last year, the state auditor's office says that is not in compliance with the required accounting. And if you want a clean actuarial opinion, you're going to have to change that. And it has been changed. It has been changed as of now to where the market value of the assets in the post fund is its asset value. Now, that lowered the assets and, again, turned from invisible to visible, which is, of course, what GASB was trying to do, and the state auditor. The unfunded liabilities in the post fund that are almost entirely a result of 2000 to 2002 in the investment market. Well, if you look at the next two columns, you'll see the first column, the one that, for example, is 10.61% for MSRS state, is what the numbers would have been in the new valuation if the unfunded liability in the post fund were still hidden. You now put it on the books and recognize it and have to fund for it, as opposed to hope that the market makes it up for you, which is really what was happening. And you'll see that it's a significant increase in the required contribution rates from what it would have been based on how the calculations were being done a year ago. So while all of these, going to the next column, show that they're not sufficient, not by huge amounts, although pretty big amount for the state employees, that a substantial part of the difference for the state employees and all of the difference for the other two big plans is a result of this accounting change. That the para-general plan and the TRA would both be sufficient without that accounting change. Moving to the next to last column, the recommended assumption changes, and that's all of them, not just the ones that are in front of you, but the ones that have to go to the full legislature, would improve somewhat the state employees' plan numbers, but not make them sufficient. But going to the right-hand column, but it will get fairly close, given that the legislature has already enacted future improvements for state employees, 0.4%. And even I'm going to come back to that. For the general employees, the legislature has already enacted increases that just about bring it into balance. Since TRA doesn't have any scheduled increases, their situation is slightly better, but it's still 1.3% of pay off. I'm going to digress for a moment. You'll see later in this that one of the things that is true for all of the systems is because the markets for the last four calendar years, which is what we're talking about, have gone straight up. The smoothing procedure on the assets hasn't had anything to smooth. Smoothing is when you have gains and losses and you even them out. If it's all one direction, then what are we looking at? 2002, which is still a loss here. 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006. Every one of them is, for all of these calculations, using an asset value that's below market. So there is a safety margin in there, as there is supposed to be. That safety margin can be used, basically, for two things, as long as it's there. One is to cover losses if there's a bad year, what it's intended to do. But the other that it can be used is to get rid of shortfalls, in effect, to fund the shortfall with money that's already in the plan. Because those deferred pieces are just that. They're deferred, and they will come in. So what happens is the gain in 2003, say, one-fifth of that was taken in 2004, one-fifth was taken in 2005, one-fifth was taken in 2006, and the last two pieces will be taken in 2007 and 2008. Now, obviously, they're only going to be of use to you if they stay there, if they don't have to be used to offset losses. And the way the markets are jumping around these days, who knows what it's going to look like 2 weeks from now. But one of the possibilities here is that the shortfall will be paid out of money that's already in the plan. Keep your fingers crossed. Not something you have control of. On the next slide, we go do the same analysis for the other the smaller MSRS plans and smaller PERA plans. But you'll see that some things, some plans, the state patrol, the judges, clearly stand out, but even a 2% of payroll given these plans, these are not trivial numbers in terms of at least keeping them in your sights for potential action. The next slide shows those things for the same things for the two first-class cities that still run their own teacher plans. And we're going to have some more discussion of St. Paul, but that's obviously a huge shortfall. Duluth is, again, we'll also be discussing more, but it's noticeable for sure. And then finally, we go to the closed plans. And the legislators' plan and the elective officers' plans don't even make a pretense of being funded properly. Okay? We'll talk about those later. And the Minneapolis plan, it's a closed plan, but clearly there's an issue that needs to be addressed there with regard to the adequacy of the funding of that plan. Okay, our last agenda item is we've gone to each of the systems and said, given that we don't get this opportunity with you folks all that often, are there things you would like to bring to their attention? So I'd like to just run through those quickly. First, we're going to talk about those that reflect that affect many plans. The first one is the one we were just talking about, that there are substantial deferred gains because the assets aren't being valued at market. The smoothing process is in place. To my knowledge, every state does this. I shouldn't say every because there's always somebody out there. So I'd say most states. You, however, do significantly less of it than most other states because you're not doing it for the retiree liabilities. Most states have the retiree liabilities in the same fund with all the others, and the smoothing applies to the whole thing. You keep the retirees in a separate pool and are not smoothing that piece. So looking at the totality, you have less smoothing. But certainly the funded ratios would be higher and the contribution rates would be lower if you were to use market value for the non-post-fund piece. There is a very slight tendency, it's not a major one, for the costs to decline because the non-public safety plans have less generous benefits for people hired in the last 18 years. So there is still some room for movement as the people who are under the old plan, the pre-89 plan, retire. Remember, they've all been here at least 18 years. And their successors are hired in under the less generous plan. And another issue is the plans all have fixed amortization dates, that is when the mortgage is intended to be fully paid off. May or may not be good financial planning to actually get there. But one of the things that happens is the closer you come, the shorter the period over which gains and losses have to be spread or changes in assumptions, and the shorter the period over which the change has to be spread, the more volatility, the bigger the change has to be to pay off the same change. So it definitely is a factor that increases volatility. Going to individual plans, the state patrol plan, there are future contribution increases already in place, and they believe that the best way to deal with it is let those get fully implemented, see what the state of affairs is at that time, and then do the same kind of discussion as to do further change, are further changes needed or not, and if so, how should they be achieved? On the judges and correctional plans, new mortgage. As you all know, if you refinance your house, you never pay it off, but the payments go down. So they're saying for the judges and correctional plans, which are relatively modest plans and obviously pretty stable in terms of their population, you may want to consider refinancing as an option to try to deal with the contribution shortfall. Again, that's changing the timing. No free lunch. Moving to PARA, the general plan, as we've seen, the schedule that's already in place has been a positive step in addressing the funding. It would have taken care of everything without the post-fund asset method change. It's fundamentally on track. For the police and fire fund, they would like consideration of a fresh start on the mortgage. And again, let the current contribution schedule play out and then revisit whether additional changes are necessary or not. And with regard to the new employees' local government correctional fund, the contributions have been adequate and they don't think there's something that you need to address.
Mr. Levy, when you talk about they, are you speaking of what the funds have told you?
Yes. We've certainly discussed these things with them, and they've, by and large, discussed them with Bonnie as well. But at this point, I am conveying what they want you to know with regard to the future of their fund.
And is what they want us to know the same as what you want us to know?
Certainly we don't have any problems with it. When we talk about reamortization in particular, that's a financial decision. It has nothing to do with this is a pension plan or not a pension plan. It is the best of the alternatives available considering the totality of what you need to do within the pension and outside the pension. Is this the best way to address a shortfall? The issues are, in some respects, not a perfect analogy, as they would be if you decided, hey, do we want to build a new room onto the house, refinance the mortgage because we can't afford any more each month to pay, but we'd like to have a new room on the house? Or do we want to get the house paid off and we'll live without that new room? There's a certain resemblance to that in terms of the process that you need to go through in deciding whether to buy into it or not. People do have expectations. So to the extent that the legislature has already adopted certain increases, there is a human resources issue that has to be considered with regard to changing those expectations in midstream. And they're not long periods. The changes go, I think, some to fiscal 2009 and some to 2010. So the recommendation that we not tamper, or that you not tamper, the legislature not tamper, with rates where the people already have to deal with what it means to their take-home pay for additional changes.
Madam Chair.
Makes some sense.
Well, Mr. Levy, do you, when you're talking with they, do you just accept what they're saying, or do you say, hey, this is not the time for an all-weather room?
Okay. Number one, we do push back. Let's make it clear. Number two, we are not looking to help them do a WorldCom, or at least what WorldCom was trying to do, which is stay on side but be just inside the boundary on everything. Difference between Enron, which tried to go offside, a technical hockey term, which I presume in Minnesota people understand. And trying to do what WorldCom did was just stay inside the edge. So, no, we absolutely push back. And, in fact, we have had extended discussions over the recognition of the unrecognized gains on the investment side, which could make a substantial dent. And as you'll see, the recommendation for all of the ones where there is a recommendation is not to spend that money. So that's a comfort.
Thank you. Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Levy, let me ask it this way. Unless you're expecting twins and you really need the room, isn't it always better to pay off the mortgage?
If you follow that to its logical conclusion, then you never are going to own a house. Because your house is always paid off if you don't own one. How do you go out and get a house? You say, I want the house now. I want to own my own home. And I am prepared to commit some part of my future income to having that house. Now, it isn't always. The key issue isn't, frankly, do you have an unfunded liability? The key, or do you have a mortgage on the house? The key issue is, can you afford to pay it? And I can't answer that one for you.
Well, Madam Chair.
Sarah Wergen.
I think you misunderstood. You already have the house. You already have the amortization schedule. I'm talking about pushing it out for the new room.
Yeah, and I'm saying if you just got a promotion and a 30% pay raise, then the answer may be put on the new room because you can afford the added mortgage payments. And again, the other possibility is you do have twins or your mother. I just want to avoid, I'm going to quote Jimmy Carter here for a moment. Because it applies to all
mother
of us.
Mother brings money with her.
Every simple problem, every difficult problem has a simple solution, and it's wrong.
The twins.
You guys wouldn't have jobs if this were simple. Your job is to do the balancing act and to say whether it's with regard to funding the current benefits or adopting new ones, or doing as the 1989 legislature did and said, we're going to have a different plan for new hires that's less generous. You guys got elected to do that. We didn't. And we're not quite so presumptive as to pretend we were.
Thank you. Please go on.
TRA is basically giving you more key facts than key issues that they would, as we said before, the only reason their contribution with the future, or they don't have future changes, but that their contribution is deficient is because of the post-fund change. And to point out that in their case, more than half of their assets are in the post fund. They have pointed out something that, again, applies to all the plans and goes to what we just talked about, that the new market value asset valuation for the post fund, when it's 58% of their asset, makes them more vulnerable to market downturns. It changes the risk profile. But again, it's facing up to money that is going to have to come from one of those two pipes coming in, either contributions or investment income. All sorts of things go away if you get a couple of years of 10% or 15% returns on assets, which is what you've had for the last 4 years. It's not out of the question. The theory is what goes around comes around, and the early part of this century was the demonstration of it. But if any of us had the crystal ball, we wouldn't be in this room. Then, kind of a brief follow-up report on the Minneapolis teachers merger. So that at the post fund level, that's been neutralized. It does have some impact, but it's being spread out over 30 years in terms of the active fund. Duluth, as you know, is actively involved in looking at all their assumptions. There are a few recommendations already, but they're looking at all their assumptions and also looking at their benefit issues, particularly in the face of the challenges that they have coming with regard to their student body and the decline for a while, I gather, and then a leveling off. We have had active discussions with their board, with the representative of the school board, in some of these issues and in the planning, and so there are a number of complicated issues with regard to Duluth, and so they want us to bring specifically to you that that recognizing their unrecognized investment income makes a very big difference in terms of their position. St. Paul, we start by giving an update in the changes in their COLA structure and how that law change has impacted impacted them. As we said, the actuarial report shows a huge shortfall there, 8% of payroll. A fresh start 30-year refinancing covers a lot of that, brings it from an 8% shortfall to a 2% shortfall, but that's still a real number that's more manageable, obviously, than 8, but needs to be addressed. And so in their view, some state supplemental funding is necessary. That's it. I've been talking for a while.
I'd just like to wrap up just for a second.
Ms. Eidelberg.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think that the last section of discussion on issues, these are all forward-looking. These are things that the systems are going to be bringing to you. And certainly there'll be discussion around them. As it relates to the LCPR statutory, non-statutory changes and assumptions, those are based on an experience study, as we mentioned before, that was done for a period of 2000 to 2004. The study was done in 2005, and action has not yet been taken on those recommendations. And I think that is something that the systems would like you to consider today. And in the one handout that we've given you, it has the statutory and the non-statutory changes together. And I think that consideration of the ones under your purview is something that would be very helpful to the systems to move forward to start to make adjustments in the next year to their systems so that we can start to better reflect experience, past experience, going forward. Thank you.
Representative Kahn.
Looking at this St. Paul Teachers Fund, if the market stays as it is, how long would that 2% take to be erased?
Well, we are looking. All of our calculations were based on the market at the end of June of this year. Okay. These numbers are very up to date, with less than 6 months old. I have no idea what's happened in the last 5.5 months, but at that point, if the 2%, with the 2%, it would take 30 years to pay off the mortgage. Without the 2%, I'm not sure it ever gets paid off. We could go back and calculate it. We haven't done that.
Okay.
Because 30 years is the maximum for accepted accounting practice.
Yes.
So we haven't looked beyond that. But that 2% is needed just to get within the GASB boundaries.
And we have the 30 years because?
Because that's GASB standard.
And 45 years wouldn't?
It would not be in compliance. And presumably the auditors. Yeah, there's nothing to require you to fund on that basis, but you at least need to report in your financials on the 30-year basis and then report that you've underfunded it if you use 45.
Okay. Representative Kahn.
Okay. Well, suppose we don't make up that state supplemental funding for the 2%, but we're still within 2% for 30 years. And suppose we looked at a scenario where 15 years from now, we extended it to 30 again. Okay. Would that scenario work?
Mr. Levy?
Probably. Again, if everything works out.
Yeah.
One of the realities, though, is every time you don't fund at the full amount,
right.
You are, in effect, borrowing. That's the we talked about that. And you're driving up all the future rates. When you do jump up, you will have to jump up further. So I'm not going to jump on the bandwagon of underfunding pension plans after spending 40 years in the business. I strongly believe in properly funded pension plans. And so,
well, the question I'm kind of asking, though, is how long do we have to properly fund it?
Well, ultimately,
you have the 30
ultimately
years
you have as long as anybody is collecting a pension and you don't run out of money.
Okay.
And that comes at a cost. But the only time you, again, I don't want to sign on to a shell game that says, let's just keep pushing it off onto some other legislature or some other school board members or whatever, which is in effect what gets done there. But if you're pushing it off, then there's going to be a liability building up on, I guess, the city's books for pension contributions that are less than the GASB requires. They will have to report that. That may affect their borrowing rate.
They could bond, though, to pay them.
Again, I don't want to get into the investment side of it.
Okay.
In effect, apropos of what we were saying before, with regard to St. Paul, at some level, you're the victim of underfunding by your predecessors, consciously or unconsciously.
Sure.
Underfunding, neglect, other priorities, the assets available, whatever caused us to be in this position, this is primarily related to the past.
Right. Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, Mr. Levy, just to be clear, your bullet here that state supplemental funding is necessary for St. Paul teachers, is that what they told you to tell us?
Yes.
Okay, and your, because somebody's going to say down the road that this is your recommendation.
No.
But, I mean, you are suggesting that's one of the things, but there are other ways we may have to do it if we have to have this so-called rolling amortization rates where we do it for 30 years and a couple more years do it 30 years. You're not, that's possible, but, okay. So there's a few options here beyond the state supplement funding. Okay, thanks.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
As we're going through this, we're talking post fund and active fund. Is there any benefit? I mean, there's been some people talk about combining the funds as a point. Other states have combined funds. Is there any benefit or any changes that would come about with that? Would it be able to stretch out the time that we need to pay these things back?
Mr. Levy.
In and of itself, it doesn't change anything. Its primary purpose, as I understand it, is to make it possible to have some clear mathematical rules for what increases pensioners get, and that obviously is potentially lost if it's rolled in. The funding is now being treated as if it were rolled in. It's terms of the required contribution rates. So if you did, as some states do, which is move to a formula that doesn't depend on assets with regard to pensioner increases, or do as other states do, which is make it purely ad hoc, or something that doesn't require knowing the retiree's share of the assets in terms of figuring out the entitlements, then it makes it a lot easier to implement something like that. But the funding right now is, in effect, as though the numbers we've given you are as though they were all one fund.
Okay. So then there's really no, Madam Chair, there's really no benefit then to doing that, in your opinion?
We would be showing you the exact same numbers right now if it were pooled as if they're separate.
Okay. Representative Kahn.
Is the rolling amortization a violation of GASB standards?
It is not. One of the consequences
is this
of,
on the edge?
Kind well, of. No. Oh, no. GASB makes no differentiation. I guess as a professional looking at it, I feel differently about it if it's rolling 30 years, where you're paying, where if everything works out as expected, your unfunded liability is expected to keep getting bigger every year because you're not even paying the interest on the unfunded liability in that when you're on a 30-year rolling period. When you keep pushing it back, it just doesn't happen. The mathematical models show the liability, the unfunded liabilities, getting smaller as a percent of pay, but bigger in dollars, compared to if you were talking about a rolling 15-year period, where you're building up some significant assets as you go. And again, I'm an unabashed advocate for funding the plans well, not badly. So as far as GASB is concerned, you can have what that's equivalent to. Obviously, Representative Kahn has some familiarity with these issues. It's like every year you refinance your mortgage over a new 30 years. And you can do that forever, and eventually you die, and somebody sells the house and pays off the mortgage, and the kids get less. That's what it's about, and that is absolutely permissible. And it's just a question of whether it's a good fiscal decision.
Well,
but it is an option.
Well, I think the point is with a public plan, particularly for something as big, we never expect there not to be a St. Paul school system. It's not going to die.
Yeah, you'll notice of the, whatever it was, half a dozen reasons for funding I gave, the one that I gave the least support to was benefit security.
Yeah.
No, you.
Yeah.
I expect every person who taught in St. Paul or teaches in St. Paul, one way or another, will receive a pension when he or she is entitled to it. But all the other things, all the other five or six reasons I gave for funding don't go away because of that. And again, one looks at the totality of the reasons for funding, not, hey, let's cherry pick the one that says, let's never fund it at all. Now, having said that, just one last quick comment. Personally, I'm not of the school.
Let's not fund it this year when we have all kinds of budget problems.
I understand. What happens when you, if you ever really were to get to fully fund it? The cost drops precipitously because you no longer have one of the two elements. Either the state spends it on everything else it wants to do, or the benefits are improved and you got an unfunded liability all over again. So the concept you talked about before, that at some point it gets a little too short and you refinance then, actually makes some sense. But to have a very long period and keep it there results in such low funding that the unfunded liability increases, and I'm not happy with that.
Senator Wetzel. Yeah,
Mr. Levy, I understand from an actuarial standpoint that combining funds doesn't make the liabilities go away. They just show up somewhere else, and they need to be tracked. But one of your other points was on volatility, and you said smaller plans tend to be more volatile. If you roll a smaller plan into a larger plan, you still have to track the liabilities, but in the long run, doesn't that make the smaller plan, now part of a bigger plan, less volatile because, you know, they've got a more to draw upon?
Well,
Mr. Levy.
That's more an issue with regard to that's not an issue with regard to rolling the post fund in. Mm-hmm. It would be an issue with revolving with moving Duluth or St. Paul into TRA. It would be an issue with moving MRF into PARA or some of those other changes. But we do the calculations as the contribution rates the same way we would do them if the post fund were rolled in.
Okay.
So given that we already recognize that totality, that particular change wouldn't make any difference. It would be primarily a change in how you determine what the entitlements are of the retirees.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Okay. Anything else?
Thank you.
Thank you so much. We appreciate your comprehensive review.
Well, I'm glad that it's as important as it is to you. I'm actually going to tell one more little story from another state. It's quick.
We can use the story.
The day before an election in another state where I was the actuary, I was having lunch with the state treasurer, who was an ex officio member of all the retirement systems.
Who we've eliminated in this.
And I said, okay. And I at the end of lunch, I said to him, you know, I really appreciate how important the pension issue is to you. And, of course, it's the biggest block of money his office managed. But why are you having lunch with me the day before you're up for re-election? And he said, because I'm both a Republican and Democratic candidate for state treasurer in tomorrow's election. And what it turned out was he was a Republican. In the Democratic primary, there wasn't anybody named. There was an interesting gubernatorial primary on the Democratic side, so a lot of people crossed over. And with no name on the ballot for treasurer, they just wrote him in. And he got more votes in the Democratic primary for state treasurer than any of the other write-ins. So then he had to decide whether to take it, and obviously he did.
Mr. Levy, will you come back? Mr. Burke has a question. Mr. Burke?
Mr. Levy, on page 27, where you're laying out the evaluation results for MRF, you indicate a current statutory rate of 108%, almost 109%. But then you have a required rate, which is much higher. Now, my understanding was that the rate that you come up with through the actuarial work is the contributions that will actually be made. So I'm trying to understand why there's a difference between the second column there for MRF and the final column there.
No, the final column is under the statutory funding policy and with the assumptions that are in place, both statutory and the ones set by this group, what rate would be required. It is not what rate is actually there. There's no question that the MRF situation from a financial point of view is seriously inadequate in terms of the funds that are going into that plan. But the 187% rate is what our calculations show ought to go in, and the 108% rate is what is actually going in. Does that help? Or if you look back on page 31, you'll see that in dollars, percent of pay for that plan, because it's a closed plan, is not a particularly relevant number. But $12.5 million a year short absolutely is.
Madam Chair, my question is, why isn't the amount that's going to go into MRF the full amount required? My understanding is that under law for that particular plan, that is what, in fact, the required contributions would be, and they would be the amount that is, in fact, payable.
Fine. I am going to be rescued here.
Madam Chair, Mr. Burek, the differentiation, well, two things. First, we only have 200 active employees, so when you do it as a percentage of pay, you end up with weird results. But more importantly, what they refer to as required has nothing to do with what the employers are paying in any of these plans. That's if you fully fund the post fund. So in other words, what they're doing in their new schedules has nothing to do with the MRF contributions. It's effectively, in my own mind as I look at this, saying, well, what if we merge the post funds in with the active funds? What would be required? But it isn't, in fact, required for any plan in the state. In my own mind, it's a misnomer when they call it required, because, in fact, the legislature has not merged these post funds in with the active and is not required funding of it. All we did is change how we show it on our financial statements so that people would be aware of the negatives in our post funds at PARA, at TRA, and at MRF. The reason the numbers show up so large is, unlike those plans, we've been closed for 30 years, and there's under 200 active. So if you take all the money coming in towards the unfunded as a percentage of 200 people's pay instead of the 5,000 members, you end up with apples and oranges, essentially. But your question is clearly valid. It's not required. MRF continues to be funding where the actuary calculates the full amount the employers must pay, including the state, and all of that is still paid in, and it always equals 100. Very good question.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bergen.
I'm really happy if Mr. Burek understood that, but I didn't understand it at all.
Madam Chair, the final column there apparently would be relevant if MRF's active and post funds were merged together. Right, and the loss in the post fund was recognized. But currently we don't do that. MRF's post fund is, in fact, separate. And so what matters in terms of the contributions that would actually go into the plan is the number shown in the second column. So ignore the third column for now.
Thank you.
Mr. Martin.
For the benefit of members, MRF is the only of our various large plans that actually is required to have a contribution rate equal to what the actuarial work shows is needed. With all of our other plans, we set contribution rates. We do it with an eye to the actuarial work, but there's never in any given year an actual squaring up where the contribution rates will go up or go down based on last year's actuarial work. MRF is different in that that's the way it's set up. Whatever the actuarial work shows is what MRF is supposed to get as a contribution. And that's why Mr. Burek was raising the question in the first instance that since the actuarial work drives the contributions, why are there these differences? And the differences are we have a debt related to the retirees, which will be recouped out of future investment earnings in excess of 6% for MRF. That there is money that will be recouped from not paying future benefit increases until that debt is paid down. That's the current structure. That's this post fund business and why the debt in the post fund either is handled or not handled. The numbers you're seeing here assume that debt in the post fund is just like the unfunded pension liability in MRF, and that the employers and the employees are obligated to pay it off.
Okay.
So that helps.
Ms. Johnson?
It was very well said. Okay. Thank you.
So everything's all transparent then? Senator? Okay.
I'm okay.
Okay.
That was very helpful.
Any other questions? Is there anyone in the audience that wants to react to any particular thing that was said in any way? And Mr. Levy expressed everything they want us to hear? Good. Thank you. Mr. Stoffel, Duluth teachers propose actuarial assumption changes. Don't run out now. Oh, good. Mr. Stoffel.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I believe in your packet there is a letter from me dated November 28th to Representative Murphy requesting a hearing today on our actuarial assumption changes, explaining what we have done to evaluate our assumptions. We have recently had an experience study done that covered the 4 years, fiscal years 2003 through 2006. And the actuaries are here today. They've explained to you a little bit in summary fashion what some of the recommended changes are that they're making. Our board has approved all the changes that require Pension Commission final approval. So on the chart that's also in your packet, it's titled Table of Actuarial Assumption Changes. I guess I would direct your attention to that table, and everything in the far right-hand column that's listed as LCPR approval, that's what we're requesting approval for today. They've all been approved by the actuaries, or recommended by the actuaries, approved by the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund Board of Trustees, and final approval is required by members of the Pension Commission. So really, specifically on this table, items number 7, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and 17.
7,
7,
9,
10, 11, 12, 13, and 17. Some of the things I skipped over are items that require no change. So you can see that in the column where under new, there's no change recommended. So the items I'm highlighting are the ones where essentially the biggest item, I'd summarize this even further to say that the biggest item of change really is new mortality tables. People are living longer. Our retirees are living longer. Beneficiaries, disabilitants, active members are all living longer, so we're really requesting changes to our mortality tables. Retirement rule of 90 usage is also up in the later ages, so that's another one, a little bit less significant. But the most significant thing we're asking for today is on this list. If I would direct your attention to the most significant thing is the change in mortality tables. So it's what I would characterize as rather non-controversial. The actuaries are recommending it. Our board has approved it, and we're looking for final approval from this body today. There is a cost to the plan for all of this, I would also say. So we're doing this knowing that this will ultimately increase the cost of the plan by about 1% of payroll, assuming that all the other assumptions are met going forward. Positive investment gains will reduce that and so forth. You've heard all that already, but this action today will increase the cost of the plan to a small degree.
Madam Chair. On that point, just to be clear then, by increasing the mortality rate, that would then result in a cost to the Duluth School District that they'd have to pick up the cost in their payroll then? Is that you're saying that?
Madam Chair, Mr. Senator Betzel, no. The answer is no to that, okay, because our contribution rates are locked in. The actuarial cost is increasing to the plan. Similar to the answer you heard from Murph, the actuaries are going to calculate a higher cost. That does not translate to a higher contribution rate. That takes an action in law to raise contribution rates for Duluth Public Schools. So our employer rate is 5.79% today. That stays the same if you vote these recommendations in today. The only way the contribution rate could be increased is if you pass a bill that does that. So the actuarial cost is increasing. The contribution rates are not. So we'll have that deficiency is growing by a small amount, which we need to amortize and pay off over time.
Senator Wergen.
Madam Chair, so subsequently we would have to at least if we're going to be financially prudent, do a contribution increase in law.
Madam Chair, Senator Wiggin, I wouldn't say that's absolutely not necessary to have a contribution rate increase. Investment experience is going to play a big part of whether we need a contribution rate increase or not. Some of the material that the actuaries presented to you today indicates that if we were to realize total full market value of assets, we'd be 96% funded. So that's the safety net that we have. I mean, there's a lot to the discussion as to whether or not we need contribution rate increases. We're not seeking that today. I don't think we'll be looking for that in a bill this session because of the assumption changes that we're making.
Senator Wiggin.
Madam Chair, so you're sort of seeking to do the easy stuff but not bite off the hard piece.
I don't think.
Madam Chair, Senator Wiggin, again, I respectfully disagree with calling it easy. It's something that the actuaries on a professional basis are recommending that, to go back to Mr. Levy's moonshot idea, we're missing the moon. We want to get on target. What is the true actuarial cost of the plan? So let's get the moonshot lined up better. Now the question is, we're short contribution rates. That's question number two. Do we need to raise the contribution rates? That's a valid question, one we're not addressing today specifically, but one that needs attention. And we can address that several ways by changing the amortization date. We can address it by realizing market value. We can also realize it by raising contributions. But there's several ways and techniques, similar to Senator Betzel's earlier question related to St. Paul, several ways to address a deficiency in contribution rates. Doesn't mean you automatically should think we have to raise contribution rates. There are other techniques.
But Madam Chair, and it may very well be in Duluth's situation, good investments, you know, will take care of the whole matter. But if people are living longer in Duluth's teacher's plan, they're probably living longer in other plans as well, too. And at some point, you know, if we start, you know, and obviously if the actuarial assumptions are that the people are living longer and we have to make adjustments, we'll have to do that. But the answers are not going to be as simple, because in other plans where the deficiencies are quite significant, we may have to say, well, I guess we now do have to raise the contribution rates in order to cover these actuarial assumptions. So this is something that, you know, we can't just look at you isolated, because when we do covers all pension plans here. I mean, you're only here representing your plan, of course, but we have to be cognizant of what's happening elsewhere. And if your investments do falter, you will be back asking for a contribution increase. So,
Mr. Stoffel.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, my only response is you're correct. I only represent Duluth teachers. I can't address the other plans. And when investments do falter, as they did in 2000, 2001, 2002, we did not approach you about contribution rate increases. We do that very carefully and very cautiously. And there will be a time, possibly, that we have to come to this body and look at contribution rate increases. But that's a very careful step that we would take if we determine that to be a necessary thing with your advice and counsel and the consultation of the actuaries and so forth. But
Representative Kahn.
I don't understand everything that's in 6, the amortization method. Just
Mr. Stoffel.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, the amortization method that we are currently under requires us to be fully funded by the year 2032. That's 30 years from the last date that we were fully funded. So surpluses were amortized on a rolling 30-year basis, as opposed to what you heard about deficiencies. Underfunding is amortized at a fixed date. So we sort of inherited the date of 2032 because that was the last date that we had a surplus in our plan. So we have a closed amortization period of July 1, 2032, and the recommendation column indicates that that there be an ongoing review and a broader study with our board and with the LCPR. It kind of goes to your issue, Representative Kahn, of should we use something like a rolling 30 or something other than these fixed dates. So it's a study item. That's what that's getting at.
Okay. Mr. Stoffel, Mr. Levy, in his comments, addressed something and said that the board hadn't taken action. What was that about?
Madam Chair, I think it was referring to some of the statutory changes that could be made to the assumptions as well, like the inflation, the investment assumption, and I'm not exactly sure what all the assumptions he was really referring to. The board has decided that our investment assumption should stay where it is at 8.5%. We've had our investment consultant look at our asset allocation. For the last 10 years, we've exceeded our actuarial assumption. We've earned over 9% on a 10-year average as of June 30, 07. Our assumption is 8.5%. Given our asset allocation today and historical asset allocation or asset returns, we're comfortable with the 8.5%, realizing it's a bit aggressive as far as public funds, but we're standing by the 8.5%. On the inflation, we really aren't studying that. We're not about to address that in any way. So I think really what he was referring to were statutory changes that may be required.
All right. And Mr. Stoffel, what happens if we hold this over until a later time?
Madam Chair, you could lay it over if it needs additional study or comment or research from staff, et cetera. I guess my inclination would be to ask you to approve these before we embark on the next annual valuation report, which would be done for June 30 of 08, which happens during the late summer, fall of 2008. So we've got time to look at this issue if you care not to do anything today. If you don't do anything at all for over a year or something, our moonshot's going to be continued, to the left or to the right. Some of our aim is left, some is right, and we want to get it right on. So the assumptions are kind of going in both directions. We're trying to get the target dead on or close to dead on as possible. So no urgency today if you care not to make changes, but we would really like to get these in place for our next actuarial valuation.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kahn.
I don't understand how we act without doing a bill. Do we? What is this thing we're just talking about, LCPR?
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, the ones that are in the right-hand column again, yeah, that are labeled LCPR, the statute that we operate under indicates that you have final approval on these assumptions. Oh. The other ones that are above, the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 items with the Minnesota Statute 356, those would require a bill. Everything else just requires your final approval. The actuaries have recommended it. Our board has approved it. We're looking for final recommendation. That's the way the law reads, so on those assumptions.
The bill is no. The law is just requires us to do this.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
So we
set
you
as yes. 7-3. Yes. Okay. Yes. Madam Chair.
Representative Kahn.
Is there any reason not to approve it today?
I don't see any reason not to do it. But
well, Madam Chair, the concern that I've got is that I think some of these issues, specifically the mortality rate, is going to be coming at us, I think, in a different plan. And, I mean, I can already hear the argument saying, well, you did it for Duluth, do it here.
It's not good to do.
And so
Madam Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
Specifically, Minneapolis is coming in.
As I see it, it's not really good to do it. A plan would be better off, it's not like, oh, that's a great thing, let's get on the bandwagon. As I understand it, a plan would be better off not changing their mortality rates. They're kind of taking a harder look at it, mm-hmm. and so I think actually that's kind of an argument for doing it as soon as possible. Because it isn't the kind of thing like, okay, we'll give you an easier rule of 90 so everyone else wants to do it. This is something I think other plans would resist doing.
Madam Chair, it's my understanding that extending the mortality rate is going to be one of the Minneapolis issues coming at us. And Minneapolis has some concerns about that because then they are going to have the contribution rate increase to pay for it. And so I think we better be cautious on what we're doing to make sure that the argument isn't, well, you've done it for one, you're going to have to do it for other, and Minneapolis is going to have to pay for it now. So.
Madam Chair.
Senator Wergen.
Madam Chair and Senator Bethel, but the fact of the matter is that this is a more realistic mortality table. And so it's prudent.
I don't know. We haven't had the presentation on the other one yet. So,
If I could make one comment as well, Madam Chair. Every year, for as long as we keep the outdated mortality tables in place, we realize actuarial losses every year. So the losses are running through the books on an annual basis. So what we're saying is, let's realize them and take them into account now in kind of one fell swoop, as opposed to, and I appreciate what Senator Bessel is thinking in light of the other funds, but I guess the way we'd like to manage the funds and the way the actuaries are recommending managing the fund is have a better moonshot, because every year that you're off, you've got to adjust a little bit anyway, so let's just kind of get it right on target right now. We take an actuarial loss because of mortality every year. And we take a large salary gain, which offsets, you know, those two offsetting things. We have salary gains, mortality losses every year because our assumptions are off kilter. We're trying to get them on kilter. It results in a recognition now of higher actuarial costs going forward, right. But we're doing it in one fell swoop as opposed to every year just kind of dealing with this fluctuation. So the cost impact is going to be there one way or another.
Well, maybe
you want to ask the actuaries about that. I'm sounding like an actuary.
I thought the Minneapolis question on mortality was for a study. Am I wrong?
Well, I don't know exactly what's going to be proposed, but if the idea of people are living longer, Duluth, that's going to happen across the board. It's going to happen in a lot of funds. Well, some funds may not be able to absorb that without a contribution increase. So we have to be prepared and just understand that, maybe Duluth can say, sure, our people are living longer, and so therefore we'll take the a bit of a decrease in the fund and we'll cover it with investment returns. Other funds are not going to be in that situation, but we're now heading down that road, so we're going to have to say, well, okay, we may have to be voting for contribution increases to pay for the fact that people are living longer in other plans too. And
Northeastern Minnesota has so much less stress than the rest of the state. And so we do manage to live really good.
You don't go outside.
Mr. Rice, can you clarify the study part of the thing?
Madam Chairman, Brian Rice, I'm the attorney for the Minneapolis Police Relief Association. Almost a year ago, early in January this year, our actuary wrote to you, members of the Pension Commission, and said that he is, in his actuarial opinion, determined the current mortality table for the Minneapolis Police is not accurate, and it's significantly understating the liabilities of the plan, as he's required to do by your statute. And in essence, there is a current request not to study the matter, but to implement mortality tables that he's recommending to you. He, like Mr. Levy, is a certified actuary in the same certification level, and he said that you are not accurately depicting the liabilities of this plan, and that's a matter that the Relief Association is saying needs to be addressed by this fund. You have done these mortality tables in the past for PRA Police and Fire, for the Highway Patrol, for Minneapolis Fire, and you've adopted tables, the 1983 JM table, just like you did earlier this year when you said to the funds, disclose your assets. We don't want this myth that, you know, you're fully funded in the post fund. You said for a transparency purpose for the public, put it out there and say these are the liabilities, these are the costs, these are the true asset things. Likewise, I would say, and I'm not here on behalf of Mr. Stoffel, I am responding to the Minneapolis issue. These items they're raising with mortality, I'm sure, are very similar to ours. People are living longer, and if you have a liability, you should put it on the books and recognize it. There is a difference, Madam Chair and Senator Betzel. You are correct. The Duluth teachers are not asking for a contribution increase. In Minneapolis's case, though, if you do adopt the mortality table, because of current state laws, it's going to necessitate an increase. Because it's a closed fund, the city of Minneapolis would be required to make up whatever the unfunded liability is in a period by 2020. But that you've done that before in other plans, specifically Minneapolis Fire. And again, I'm not here on behalf of Duluth, but I think the reality is you know, Mark Twain was wrong. The death and taxes aren't necessarily certain, at least in this case, or a death at a certain late. And people are living longer, and I would submit that putting it on the books and recognizing it is at least a step in that direction. Now, obviously, we do have an interest. We'd like to see the Minneapolis mortality table adopted. There are some implications for that, but this is a matter that the Pension Commission has had before it and other funds, and that's how you do your, you know, it's how you operate. And so, talk too long. We are not asking for a study. We are asking you for almost the same thing that Mr. Stoffel is doing to implement it. The effects are different, however. Senator Betzel, you're right. In this case, there is no contribution increase that would flow from this necessarily. In Minneapolis, there likely will be because of the shortness of time, but actually measuring that will be, again, dependent on investment performance, a number of other factors that come into play. So,
thank you for that clarification.
And so, Madam Chair?
And, Mr. Rice, I do have the Minneapolis situation on the agenda for a January or February meeting. Representative Nelson?
So, Madam Chair and Mr. Rice, you're saying that I think that Senator Betzel is saying that we're not, if we vote to approve this recommendation, we're not setting a precedent that other people are going to come in and say, well, you let them do it without an increase, therefore we get to do without an increase.
No,
and that's, you're saying that's not going to set a precedence or a...
Well, Madam Chair, I think Senator Betzold is right to this extent, that every time you adopt a mortality table, the next person's going to come in and say, well, you did it for the Highway Patrol, you did it for PRA Police and Fire, you did it for... really, all the plans have come in and dealt with this issue. I think it's fair to say, I don't want to speak for the other funds, but I know within the last 4 or 5 years, PRA has come in, I think, and updated their assumptions, because that's just good management practice to really say, here's what we're dealing with, folks. These are the liabilities, like it or not. These are the facts. I do think there is a difference, in my case from Duluth, that... While Duluth's mortality table is going to increase actuarially the unfunded ratio or the necessary by 1%, they're not asking the next step, which is a contribution increase, because there are other factors that can address that possibly, the unrealized gains between the difference between actual variable value and market value. You could extend the funding date as an option, as a tool in your toolbox that Representative Kahn said, either a 30-year rolling or a 25-year rolling, or pick another fixed date. There are other issues that come into play on that. But, no, I do want to say here, I'm not on the agenda today for Minneapolis Police. I do want to say we think the increase is necessary, or the assumption change is necessary. There is a resulting cost to the city to do that, because they're the funder of last resort. I think I've also presented, I think now to all of you, a booklet that shows over time, in good years, the city has benefited enormously, and they paid nearly nothing to this fund, no levy. And in other years, when the market is corrected, they've had to make changes. But that's just the way it works. And if you want a fully funded pension fund, which my client does, somebody has to pay for it. And you can pretend people aren't living longer, but they're... Fact is, a hole gets built up every year. The roof is leaking in Minneapolis Police, and our actuary told us that 5 years ago, and we'd like to fix the roof so the leak doesn't wreck the house.
Madam Chair.
Not put a new room on.
We're not putting a new room on.
Just fixing the leak.
Senator Bergen.
Madam Chair, it just seems to me that for us as a pension commission, the bottom line should be that we want the pensions to be as accurately reflected as possible. And if a change like this is necessary to get a real accurate reflection, then we have to do it. Yeah, we have to face the consequences of what that means as far as contributions. But at the same time, I think we have to have them. I think the people that are part of these pensions deserve as great accuracy as possible.
Well said.
Well, Madam Chair, and I agree with that.
Senator Betzel.
And I agree with that. And the test should not be
that we decide to grant the actuarial changes based upon whether or not there will be a contribution increase or not. And to have one fund say it's not going to affect us doesn't mean we should say yes to them. And if somebody else comes in at a later date and says, well, ours will have a contribution increase, we say, well, we can't do that.
Well,
but we don't look at these things in a vacuum, and that's the point I'm trying to make, that we do need to realize what the implications are when the other funds are coming in here.
And Madam Chair, I think Senator Betzel's right on that point. The actuary earlier, I think you asked the question, like, what's the right answer? I can tell you what I think, and I don't know if the actuary did or didn't. He kind of generally told you what I thought. Ultimately, you're the deciders. I mean, ultimately, you have to weigh all these things with a calculus that's not just, you know, it's you know, black or white. There's things. So I think it's appropriate. I think I'd like to say that hopefully when we do come before you in January or February, we have a strong case that mortality needs to be done, and we'd also be willing at that time, and we tried to say that our current assumptions for this particular plan on other matters, investment, growth, salary, are appropriate for our plan. Now, of course, if the legislature says, well, we'll do one, but we also want to look at these other assumptions, and I think even Mr. Stoffel's suggestion here says there are some actions the Pension Commission may need to do on items 4 and at least 4 possibly and 3, where there are some statutory changes that go along that will need to be made. And I know that I think what the presentation is leading up, that the Pension Commission is likely going to have a number of both actuarial changes that you do and also ones you'll recommend to the full legislature. And I think you should take those on the merits as they come forward and address them. Make your decision, hear the arguments, and decide them in the forum that is currently provided.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that regardless of what action we take on this today, we're going to have the discussion about Minneapolis and the other funds. I'm comfortable moving forward today with this, but I think that, you know, I think back to what Mr. Levy said a little earlier, in that the condition of today's fund is in part due to what previous legislatures have provided for us. And as it relates to people living longer, we need to make the correct assumptions so that, you know, that future legislature 20 years from now isn't trying to mop up our problem because we didn't want to address the problem. And so I think that, you know, we're going to have to take a real hard look here anyway on the Minneapolis issue, because we, you know, I don't think we want to make a problem worse. We've faced problems here just in the recent past where we either pay a little now to be in a better financial position, or we pay a whole lot later. And I don't think we want to increase those circumstances where we have to pay a whole lot later. But you know, obviously we can do whatever with this we're going to do today, but it seems to me we're going to have to address the issue at one point or another.
Mr. Stoffel, once again, tell me who approved this list.
The list was approved by the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund Board of Trustees at their November board meeting on advice from the Siegel Company actuaries, who did the experience study looking at 4 years' worth of actual data compared to assumptions. So again, the experience study compares actual history to assumed experience, and we're making that adjustment.
And the school district?
The district was not involved, Madam Chair. This is really the business of the pension fund. So the school district, in our case, is the employer.
And the school district has representatives on the pension board.
Yes. Yes, Madam Chair, we have one member from the school district. From the school board, and the superintendent of schools also sits on our board. So there are 2 of 9 board members from the employer side, and the rest are the other 7 members are active and retired teachers.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Madam Chairman, you know, from everything I've heard on this, I just don't see any sense in not doing it today. I mean, I think we're going to have to look at each one of these plans individually. And I think that, everything. I can't imagine what else Duluth would come in and say in a month or something like that that would change this situation. And I can't believe that we'd make a decision for Duluth based on what we think other funds might want to do. So, you know, I mean, from all, if we trust this actuarial company to give us the advice that we've listened to today, which I thought we all thought was really good, you know, I don't understand, and there's no, seems to be no controversy about this. I don't understand why we just don't go ahead today and approve it. And so if you're willing to accept the motion, I'll move that.
Representative Kahn moved.
Whatever
any
Jay wanted.
Any further discussion?
7-3.
Yeah.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Bergstrom. Okay.
Madam Chair, I'm Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the state retirement system. And Mr. Stoffel's a little wilier than I am, so if we could ask, as long as you're in the approving mood,
well,
if you would look at the and there are there's only one mortality. The floodgates have opened. There is a packet that the actuaries handed out. And all three statewide plans have recommendations. And if I could just talk briefly, we are in the process of drafting a bill to handle the statutory recommended changes, which we will talk about later that Mr. Levy briefly touched on. But if you look to the third page, so we are drafting a bill to make those changes. If you look to the third page, the
24.
Page 24, right.
Yep.
The actuary, and this actuary was made by our consulting actuary, Mercer, was agreed upon by Siegel and were approved by all of our boards. And we are asking these changes to be made by the Pension Commission because they are under your purview. So if I just go quickly across from MSRS's standpoint for the state employees, and I won't go through all of them. We are seeing fewer females leaving, which drive up the cost of our plan. We have a slight increase in disability rates, which drives up the cost of the plan. However, we're seeing fewer employees using the rule of 90, which in essence costs less for our plan. And those are the changes they're recommending. In total, they really have very little impact. You will see... on the judge's plan, we are recommending a mortality rate change there. That does have a slight cost to the it does have an increase to the cost of the program, and we will bring you some alternatives for contribution rate increases or amortization changes. All of the other plans, we've already strengthened our mortality tables in the last year or two. The judges, we are not. So, Madam Chair, what we are respectfully asking is if the Pension Commission could approve these changes that are under your purview, and then we will bring back a bill for the rest of the changes on the first two slides.
Madam Chair?
Senator Betz.
The last item is for Duluth. Is that what we've already done, or is that different from what?
Yeah.
So we don't need to do the last block.
Madam Chair, right. Senator Betzel, okay. That you already did.
Okay.
And we thought it might be part of the package. That's why Mr. Stoffel is so wily. And we're here following up. I used to work with Mr. Stoffel, so I should have known that he was that wily.
That he had a little sheet with it all worked out for us,
yeah.
Right? Ms. Vanek?
Madam Chair, members, Mary Vanek, Executive Director of PERA. We have just one change in this category, and that is we actually are looking at decreasing the use of Rule of 90 for ages 55 to 61 and 63 and 64, and decreasing the use of retirement for ages 61 and 62. So this is actually a slight savings to our plan because fewer people are retiring within these guidelines or this framework.
Ms. Hacking.
Laurie Hacking with TRA. For TRA, we too are just asking for one change, a little different direction, which is to increase our Rule of 90 utilization rates. Again, the changes in here have very minor impact on the fund.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Just so I get this straight in my mind, Representative Kahn asked this question to me, and this didn't change anything in the plan. It just changed the assumptions that you're using for. Okay, that's what I thought.
Any other questions?
Did you want a motion, Madam Chair?
Please.
I would move those changes to TRA, PRA, and MSRS.
Is there any further questions? Discussion? All in favor of the Larson motion, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted.
You.
Now you're all Wiley. In your packets are minutes for December 6th, April 24th, and March 28th.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel moves adoption of the minutes as printed. Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. Is there any other business to come before us today? Ooh. Thank you again to the Siegel Company and the Mercer Company, and to all of you, a happy holiday season.
See you next year.
This meeting is adjourned.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
No, thank you.
Okay.
All right.